In this episode of the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast, we continue our conversation with Ian McCune of Port Adelaide. This is honestly some of the best wisdom I've ever heard about what it's like to work in the industry and to really succeed and build a great culture. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. Maximum performance, minimum fuss. Critical wisdom and actionable insights from leading minds in the field of human performance around the globe. And now, here's your host, Jake George Schuster.
Welcome back to the Well-Traveled Wellness Podcast. I've got the flu. We've got Ian McCown back, part two of his interview. If you missed it last week, check in and listen to him talk about what it's like to be an AFL performance coach and what working with athletes in the real world versus outer space is actually like. Today we've brought Ian back to talk about some finer details of his programming and approach. So welcome back on the show, Mackers.
Thanks for having me, mate. It's great to be back 2 weeks in a row. I feel a little bit guilty for taking another episode off you guys.
Oh, we're going to be sick of each other soon. I'm excited for it. Cool, man. So we were chatting earlier a bit about exercise selection and kind of, you know, what's the method to the madness in programming. And I often find myself thinking when observing my own and others' programming, kind of what's the purpose of this session? I guess it's a little bit frustrating for those who love science how unclear we are on, you know, what adaptation really looks like and how much we can try and fit into one program and how many adaptations we can chase in one session or one block and things like that. And it's very muddy. So could you maybe just tell the audience a bit about when you're with Port and looking at that group of athletes, how do you approach both programming in the big picture, so different phases and things like that, and sessions, and then lastly, exercise selection itself, please?
Yeah, sorry, but I'll probably can't clear anything up. It's probably very muddy with me as well. It is one of those very muddy or gray areas, I think, for a lot of people. I'm particularly dealing with sports, that obviously team sports in particular, you know, where you're dealing with a wide range of strength qualities, never mind athletic qualities or physical qualities across the board. And I know that, you know, Lockie's explained, you know, the AFL sort of conundrum, which is probably we're very, very lucky in that we have to deal with these incredible athletes who, obviously, from an endurance point of view, have an obnoxious running load, and particularly the high quality running load. But then also, yeah, there's a lot of combat, there's a lot of grappling, lots of contact, lots of physical contest as well. So they obviously have to be very, very strong. And peak speeds are you know, comparable to any other, you know, team sport as well. So, you know, if not a little bit more because of the longer grind, the bigger distances they can get. So they can obviously get a max speed, a little bit easier. So yeah, there's probably a lot going on there, and it is a relatively difficult part of the puzzle to piece together. I guess sort of following on from some of the things we talked about last time, I'm pretty keen on talking about the concept of the blueprint, and just putting together a rough frame of how we deal with fitness qualities. And it's logical, it's progressive, it's no different to anyone else, really, from the grand scheme of things. If we take a step back and look at the annual plan or our concept of organization of training over a long time, I guess, you know, being a team sport, we don't peak for one particular period in time. We have to continually peak or be at a more optimal level of performance for a longer period of time. So we've pretty much two blocks. We've got pre-season and we've got in-season. A little bit of off-season, which is more of our, I consider, our resetting period, and probably taking advantage of all the great things they do throughout the other 11 months, 10 months of the year, that they do get a bit of time to recuperate. But then obviously there's a little bit of compensation going on there as well, and getting them ready for a pre-season. So within pre-season, In particular, I guess we're afforded a little bit of time there. We probably get about three or four week blocks of training in, which is, I guess, in comparison to other team sports.
It's quite long, yeah.
It's quite long. So we're pretty cool that from that point of view. So I guess I'm not going to teach a granny how to suck eggs and tell you how to do a 4-week program, I guess. But well, I guess one of the points of difference, one of the things which we do, which I think is really interesting and works very well for us, is although we work in 4-week blocks, or you know, maybe it's a 5-week block, depending on the dates, whether it's an extra week into Christmas, I'm not going to worry too much about that. But I guess what's really interesting for me is that we work in 2-week cycles. So I guess from a bigger picture point of view, we have consistencies within the program. So whether that's developing, say, squat strength, we're going to have a 4-week loading pattern throughout that. But what we'll do is we'll only give the players like a 2-week program. So there's only like two columns, week one and week two. Obviously, the progression might be over 4 weeks, but I feel that I guess we've got so much going on within those 2 weeks. So that 2 weeks is probably, you're talking about 10 sessions roughly. It's 10 sessions for them to have, for things to go wrong, for adaptation to occur, for adaptation to not occur, for us to maybe find out things which fall flat in their face. And rather than wait for 4 weeks before we recycle the program or we reassess it, I think by doing it in 2 week blocks, and being able to continually spin through that and that constant readjustment. So it's like whether you take any of the agile periodization or any of the sort of more fluid periodization sort of concepts, and it's looking at the sprint programming. So you take little 2 week blocks and you keep on continually readjusting throughout time.
Right.
So that gives us, because there's so much going on, I think that affords us a little bit of time. And to be honest, that came as a little bit of a fluke. It's not because I read about this stuff and thought, oh, that's something I can put in place. It was probably more, to be honest, a little case of my OCD and a little bit of my feeling like everything has to be perfect with the program. So we were getting, you know, you get bashed and bruised, you get lots of knocks, you get lots of things which have to be adjusted. And rather than having your piece of paper with your program on it and scribbling, just hate the untidiness of that. And some of the players hate that too. I feel it's just a little bit nicer if you can constantly readjust. And for sure it's going to happen. Like, shit happens all the time. But I think if you can constantly be on top of that, I think that it just makes it look a little bit nicer and you feel like you're on the ball a little bit more.
Well, because we do work in an industry with like constant cyclical paradoxes. Is some coaches, cite simplicity as an excuse for not really being on top of the modern literature or advances, and some go way too far in the other direction, right? And then we see this kind of situation over and over, don't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that by being able to be that, I guess, look, underneath all of this is there has to be a true appreciation and respect for periodization models, for training physiology, for the actual adaptations which go on within the body. You can't just be, it's not just throwing shit at a wall and finding what sticks. It's a little bit, you have to respect the systems a little bit more than that and respect the science. But then I guess that's where we've talked about this before, but the art of things comes out. And I think that you have to be mindful of how you put that across. It's very true. I think there's so much that goes on. And I guess that's our way of doing it. Now, if you consider the week, if you want me to sort of break down a typical week, we would pretty much consistently go throughout the season looking at, splitting each session into two. So like an A priority and a B priority. And that A priority might be a bit like your vertically integrated modeled by Charlie Francis or any of these guys, but sort of more classical stuff. So looking at, or West Side Barbell or anything like this. So we're looking at, you know, maximal dynamic strength on one day and then looking at max strength the other and maybe looking at repetitive strength the next. But what we'll tend to do is look at that. Maybe we'll go, it might be lower body strength, but it might be upper body power in one session.
Okay.
Then we might swap it around for the next day where it might be lower body power and upper body strength.
Mm.
Rightly or wrongly, we find that that actually works quite well for us.
I tend to agree with that, Ian, because I find that you can only chase one certain neuromuscular demand for so long until the session runs out of steam.
Yeah, and look, that's like if you saw my annual planner, like how I organize each week, we have two priorities, and then we probably have a third one. And my third description is how we look at the integration of trunk work into the session. So,
oh, cool.
So we might look at that from a anti-extension sort of pillar strength point of view. You might look at that from a rotation. You might look at that from ipsilateral, contralateral stance work. And again, a lot of it's just words. But in my head, it sort of makes sense how we're challenging the body. And I guess what we're looking for is positional challenges. And that's not looking at how a back runs compared to a forward or how it's more about the positions your body has to get into and being able to challenge them in different ways.
Get out of the sagittal plane for a bit.
Yeah, scary as that may seem, that's quite a lot of what we try and do. So I hope that's a little bit clearer than it has been when I've said it there. But these are the little things which probably come out and make things muddy. That's just the beauty of it. But these are the things which you have to consider and be able to play with throughout the year. That's probably more the pre-season load where you can afford to do that. In season, I mentioned this really briefly, I think, before, but we have a reset day at the start of the week. The middle of the week, we lift heavy, and it's more about strength development and continuing that strength development. And then our third and fourth sessions are more about being able to transfer those strength qualities, those strength skills onto what they actually need to do on the field or what I feel is going to give them more readiness to perform on the Saturday.
I take that to mean that towards the start of the week, it's more about specific adaptations and the morphology and the physiology that you need the athletes to be where you need them to be at. And then towards the end of the week, it's more about transferring what you're doing. I mean, it's always about transferring what you're doing, but it's more about transferring what you're doing directly towards the on-pitch demands.
Yeah, so session one is a reset session where we're resetting the body from the game and looking at that from I look at this as a little bit of, rather than like hypertrophy, it's a little bit more high volume, but it's more from a joint health point of view, trying to get the joints moving. A little bit of, I think like Louis Simmons talks about this quite a bit with guys' elbows and shoulders when they're benching, incredible amounts of load that, you know, you still need to have that repetition in their body, in the joints to make sure that, you know, the hinges are working well, I guess. And that's, and it's a perfect analogy for me. We probably just need to get the creaks out of the hinges as soon as we can at the start of the week.
Yeah.
And that sets up recovery and sets up, takes away as much maladaptation as we can from the body and as much unneeded stress. We know how it's a shit fight with stress as it is across the whole body, across the whole day, across the whole period of the season. So I guess if we can get rid of all those little things, the better. So reset breathing, reset joints, etc. Kelly Starrett and those guys talk about this way better than I can. But again, that's that sort of concept. We try and bastardize and steal as much as possible from that. We then go into a main session on Wednesdays, typically Wednesdays, and it's about lifting heavy. It's about making sure that we're continually challenging the body to continually improve and not maintain. Maintenance of strength is, is not a goal of mine. It's about making sure that athleticism is developed throughout the season. I guess that's so we'll check where we might be able to load as much because of the other challenges that they've got to face. We mightn't get maximal load, but we might be able to improve their depth, their control, their skill with movement. And I guess that's, you know, so over time, the net gain is greater than just looking after and trying to chase maximum strength all the time. So if we can, because that's, you're going to hit a wall because of the games and because of the compromises you're going to have to make there. But if we have an ulterior motive, which might be making sure that, you know, athletically they're moving better, that it's an opportunity which we might be able to develop some other skills. So that's what we go after. So overall, by the end of the year, hopefully you've got a better athlete who's obviously very strong, but is also better, a better mover, and then a better space, hopefully, for the year to come. You know, it's about continual development. So I guess, yeah, that's probably where we sit at the moment with it. And yeah, as I said, I appreciate that it's a very confusing and it's a very, it's what works for us at the moment. If I was to go anywhere else with a different playing group, I'd probably change everything or I'd start again and see where I came up with. That's probably just because of the 4 years of experience with this one group. We've been able to play around with things, and that's definitely not how we started off, and we'll continually develop that as we go over the years. So I guess that's hopefully it clears up, or hopefully it gives you an insight.
I've found two things recently have dawned on me, observing my own, my bosses, you know, just SNC programming around the world, is that firstly, we do a lot of things just because it's the way everyone else does them, or the way we've been told that we should do them, or because, you know, very smart man, but because, you know, how Virgo Shansky says we should do them or whatever, you know, and I'm not so sure about that. And then the second thing I've noticed is that you can call something whatever you want, but physiology doesn't give a shit, you know, that you're calling this session a flush, or, you know what I mean, or, you know, and I do like this word, but, you know, it doesn't care that you're calling this session a primer or whatever, you know, at some point we have to relate our undergrad physiology into, you know, our programming. And it's hard to do that, mostly because we're all hungover or asleep in undergrad physiology, but also because we don't know enough. Our field doesn't know enough. So I think it was just cool to hear a little bit about kind of what goes into each session. And, you know, when you're programming an exercise, are you targeting motor control or skill development or hypertrophy? And hear a bit, you know, just about how one of the pros really, really does it.
I know. It's a great topic. And I think it's funny how, like, it's one of those things that I remember back to those days, and I really appreciate now reading all that stuff and really delving deep into it and making all those mistakes with programming and with how I organize things and making sure I had everything perfect, because now I like how it sits in my head and my interpretation of it's probably completely wrong from a classical point of view, but from what I feel works and the logical progressions I can make from it, it's just how it sits in my head. And it is a hard one to communicate sometimes when you try and use other people's words, but hopefully it makes sense.
So, Mackers, we've been talking a little bit about the kind of accessory work and different types of content that you like to program and different stuff that you like to do with the power and with your AFL athletes. I think everyone has different modalities that they subscribe to. Can you just tell the audience a little bit about what work outside of your core lifts and your core sprint work that you like to do to prepare your athletes and keep them injury free?
Yeah, sure. I guess nothing's off the cards is probably the biggest thing. I think, and this is nothing new or nothing different to anyone out there, but I think as soon as you start putting a line through anything, any modality or any exercise in particular, you kind of then limit yourself, and it's still a little bit ignorant with the fact that there's always a time and a place for an exercise, whether that's a dreaded Nordic or a leg extension or like curl, like it's got some place somewhere in it for somebody. So I think that's probably from an accessory point of view. I think that the bigger the palette, or the, you know, the more tools in your toolbox, that type of thing. I think that, you know, so if I maybe sort of speak a little bit more philosophically, I guess, around things, and this is bastardizing a lot of Calvin Giles's great work, and I recommend everybody goes and listens to anything that he says, but I think one of the things he says, in terms of the, if you take the analogy of literacy and physical literacy, if you take that a little bit further, and talks about having a great vocabulary. So I think that our guys, you know, are trying to do a PhD in their work, in their athleticism and in their sport. So I think that in order to be a good PhD, you need to have an incredible grasp of lots of different things and a wide ranging skill set. So I think that we should always be challenging that. And that probably helps me because I'm not trying to be too narrow. You know, particularly when it comes to people talk about position specific work, people talk about and not just necessarily position on the field, but positions they get to in the game, that type of stuff. I think that for sure it's important. But I think that by keeping everything nice and broad and trying to give our guys as big a vocabulary as possible, and a greater skill set, I think that helps. That helps a lot of times when we're trying to look at accessory work. I guess in terms of what we do, getting into the nitty gritty off a little bit. So I think I mentioned before that typically in an annual plan, we'll have two or three themes that run through each session, and that's sort of the aim or the goal of the session. But again, one of the little descriptors which I always have in there is, and it just happens to work for us at the moment, sort of fall into place a little bit, is that we look at how we integrate trunk and accessory work into that. So I'm taking a little bit of what I've learned listening and reading a lot of Eric Cressy's work, for example, or everybody else out there, you know, in terms of we'll have anti-extension, we'll have anti-rotation, so a lot of pallet presses, lots of different positions, lots of half-kneeling, tall kneeling positions. So for we'll row, we'll push, we'll pull, we'll go vertically, we'll do all that type of stuff. And I guess trying to challenge our cylinder, I guess, or it's like a DNS sort of analogy. We're trying to keep that cylinder nice and strong. So if you imagine if your trunk's a Coke can, if you have any kinks in the Coke can, it'll crush under load. So we try and make sure that it's nice and strong. So I guess that's one of the things that, again, I'm dropping lots of names here, but people should go and Google these people. Craig Levinson is one of the guys that teaches that quite a lot and really, really well. And those guys that,
in terms of athletic development. Dan as well, I think, isn't he?
Yeah. So I've probably done really well not answering your question too well there, but in terms of, I guess, in terms of accessory work, we do aim a lot of our work around postural strength, bastardized strongman stuff a little bit, but it's mostly around rotation, trying to get these guys, these guys are pretty strong sagittally, they're pretty, but when it comes to grappling, that type of thing. We do a lot of grappling conditioning in pre-season, but I think that probably has gone the wrong way, where we've gone straight into grappling conditioning without having the foundation in that in grappling movements and the fundamentals of grappling. So that's probably something which we're just chasing our tail a little bit, and we'll get there. But our guys are getting very strong and are looking pretty good with that type of thing, and I think that's coming through with the amount of load that they can put through their trunk. You know, when they do squat, you know, it's not, we touch wood, but we don't really get too many back injuries or back, you know, from squatting heavy. And it's all relative, obviously, compared to Ben Franks, we're not squatting heavy, but compared to, you know, other people, we are. So I think that's a good tick for us in terms of our you know, again, one of our KPIs is that, or the priority for me is that we have a healthy list.
Well, if you think about the lever length that you see on some of these athletes in the AFL, and then you combine that concept with how much they have to be able to run, then squatting decent amounts is going to be pretty impressive, right?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, I'm always in awe nearly of the effort that our boys bring. Never mind the outcomes. You know, they do lift very heavy sometimes. They're 200 kilos is heavy no matter what
world it is.
In, you know, so I think that that's that's a super benchmark for us in terms of some of the things. So I think that it all helps. In terms of other accessory work, I know you sort of alluded to this off air a little bit, but we try and fill our days with as much developmental or improvement work as possible. Again, not trying to maintain but improve everything we do, so a little bit of that mindset. So we're exploring a lot of work with Eldoa and a lot of the myofascial stretching coming from Guy Boyer, which is something I picked up at Altus. Mm. And I know that everybody that's out there is sort of amazed by how much these guys do. Mm. In season's a little bit more difficult with our guys because there's a lot of effort goes into it. And I think my tickets are better spent with the guys putting their effort into their lifting sessions. I'll put in some, and particularly in rehab, we'll do quite a bit. But to be honest, it's something which I really wish we could do more of, and I wish I could sit here and say that, yeah, like I'm a big advocate for it, and I'd love to be doing it more often. But to be honest, the guys, they're not going to do it right, and then if they're not doing it right, it sort of feeds a bad habit in it, and I'd rather not do it and then pick it up back in season when we've got a little bit more time and we can put a little bit more focus on it. But saying that, you know, we do, I focus a lot on mobility and a lot of joint health and joint freedom is sort of how I think of it in my head. So particularly around hips, shoulders, and then how we play around with that. So you're getting more range through thoracic cage can, you know, all of a sudden you end up with a greater ability to go overhead. You know, in terms of our hip stuff, you know, our guys are, as you said, running an awful lot, but they're also kicking and changing direction a lot in any other sport out there except for soccer. But again, we're kicking it further probably in different positions, and we end up with quite a few horrible stiff hips and a lot of bony pathologies that we have to.
You get a fair bit of FAI and that kind of thing.
I guess we're not going to fix bones, but we can circumnavigate and we can give them as much help as we possibly can. So, yeah. So to do that, I guess I see my role there as a little bit of an educator rather than as a coach or a dictator. So I'll educate session. I'll try and teach them sessions rather than coach sessions or program. I teach rather than program. It's probably the best way to look at it. So we'll teach them how to do simple contract relax of glutes. We'll do a lot of pin and floss through quads, lateral quad. We'll do a little bit of we do a lot of upper back smashing. Our guys are, you know, like every other male in their 20s, are very sort of dominant through the upper back and very, very tight. So the more we can do in there, the better. So you know, I guess every day is nearly like a different lesson. So we'll teach them how to trick their lateral seam. We'll teach them how to trick their quads. You know, TFLs are always a nice one to get into. We've played around with a little bit of psoas work and a little bit of psoas smashing, which the boys really love. And then, I was thinking about this earlier. Everyone comes on the podcast and tells you all the great things they do, but they don't tell you the shit stuff they do or the horrible stuff that fails. But one of the good things, which I genuinely sit there and go, this is bullshit, we're doing this really well, and I've actually taken a few sneaky photographs of, is the guys doing these regen sessions where there's the lights are out, they're doing their breathing, they're just focusing on their breathing, doing a bit of diaphragmatic stuff, or they're smashing the psoas, doing a little bit of contract relax, and probably, we're getting 40 of the guys into a gym, which is a relatively small gym for 40 people, but you know, they get the barbells out and they're smashing calves and quads and stuff like that, which is really, I think it just excites me. It's probably a sad indictment of my life, but it should.
I think it's pretty hard. Pretty hard to get a group of male athletes to do that.
Yeah. And to be honest, look, for every one session they do really well, probably the third one, it ends up like, you know, primary school when the teacher goes out of the room and everything just gets louder and louder and the balls get thrown and, you know, there's always some sort of nudity or some sort of, you know, some sort of fondling going on in the room, which is going to happen when you get them all in the room together and they're a bit tired and grumpy. So, you know, we're doing it relatively well. I'm really happy with it. So one to three, I think, is a genuine win for us. And getting everyone involved. So even the grumpy old boys, as well as the young guys, as well as the guys, the rock stars in the middle, everybody gets involved and does some form of it. So I think that's in terms of our accessory work, it's probably, if I look at that as another module of our work that we do, I think that's been really cool for us.
You are one very crucial cog in a machine that is pretty well known around the world, Ian, known as one of the, the examples that people cite for a high performance culture, a high performance staff, or whatever words you want to use for that. Can you tell the audience what are your three biggest keys to creating and keeping such a culture, both in terms of staff and the management operations and the management of the athletes themselves?
I don't know how to, I don't know. I'm only going to fail after that introduction, I think. It's very, very kind of you. For me, I said, guided off Virgil's leadership, I guess, is probably the first thing. And one of the things which he has done really well, obviously in my very biased opinion, is that he's let me do what he's given me autonomy and given me the respect and the responsibility to carry out a program which I feel will work, and work over time and not necessarily change everything in one day, but slowly over time. We're very strong on where we want to go. We can all quote, passages from Legacy. We can all quote passages, if you're really into your, into that side of things, you're always going to have, and to be honest, there's always going to be cliches, but I think the biggest thing is having really good people involved in the system. And that goes from the players right through to I'm sort of inheriting players and that side of things, but you want to work with really good people, good players, good coaches, good people, coaches who are people, and then also the people that you work with. So in terms of our sports medicine, sports performance team, I guess that's been a really big focus for us, and we've been very lucky that's fallen into place for us. And I see the huge benefit in that. I think that you got to have good people who also want to learn, I think, and share. It's probably the big thing. You can be a good person, you can be really crap at your job. I'm not too fussed if you want to get better. I'd rather have someone that wants to get better and really wants to put in the effort to do that. I think that's the growth mindset type of thing. I think we all need to have that. And as a collective group, we've got to be able to show that. I don't know. I wouldn't dream of trying to consult or put my words into any other high performance, whatever the hell that means in the first place, into any environment like that. But I think that, for me, that's the big thing is having good people that want to learn. And I sort of go around in circles with this a little bit sort of throughout my career, working in institutes and working with developmental athletes. And I guess, working at the professional side, I really see I'm incredibly privileged to be where I am. And I think that no matter where you work, I think that, we've got to have the softer side of things. We've got to have that right. You've got to be really, really good at that. You've got to be very self-aware. You've got to be developing. You've got to take the time to reflect yourself. And, some people call it meditate. Some people just take a good hard look in the mirror sometimes. Whatever you want to coin it as. But I think for me, I'm sort of coming around to the idea that you got to be sort of unapologetically elite in terms of your mindset to what you want to do. I'm sorry, but I don't want to just be good at what I do. I want to be the best in the world, or I want to be in that conversation. And I don't care who judges that. It's just more for myself. I want to feel that what we're doing, I'm really happy with. So that's a sort of, there's the soft and fluffy side about being a good person, but there's also the brutality of that as well, where, I've got to come home, I got to take days off, and on those days off, I'm doing work, I'm talking to people, I'm trying to tie up conversations with the people that I respect all over the world pretty much every week to try and make myself better. And it's sort of unapologetic in the end, about that. And obviously you've got to have a balance, and we all know that, but I can't remember who said, I saw it somewhere recently, obviously on Twitter, some someone put it on Twitter, I think, about, you know, we are different. If you want to be, it was Paul Devlin, I think, who's at Paramount Appeals. He put something out about, I don't know where he picked it up from, but said, if you want to be elite, if you want to be, you got to be different. You can't be the same as everybody else. So you can't have the same holidays and the same. So I think that that's probably the other side of it as well. And that's a little bit uncomfortable. And that's a little bit, I said, there's a bit of brutality in that. And I think that you have to be able to thrive with that as well. So, like, yes, I wouldn't dream of giving anybody, you know, that sort of, this is the three keys to high performance sport, and, you know, that, or you'll not succeed. But I think that, you know, for me, that's sort of how I try and live my life, or try and live my coaching life. So, you know, as long as, you know, if that means anything to anybody and they appreciate that, that's all that I really want to communicate, I guess.
No, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I really like that last point, Mackers, because it's something I've actually noticed quite a lot recently in people in the field that I really look up to. I think, did you say ruthlessness? I think that's it's a good word for it. I've thought of it almost as like a fearlessness, and maybe even a pride about being really good. You know, it's not, like you said, there's not much room for being soft beyond a certain point. You can be soft in a positive way, but then at some point you have to just go. You have to, you know, you're either doing things or you're not. You're either making it or you're not. And I mean, I think the best competitors on the pitch thrive under pressure. So in the practitioner side, I don't know why it should be any different.
Yeah, and I think there's so much goes into this in terms of personality and backgrounds and things like that. But I think that as long as you say you can have pride and you can, but I tell you, if I've learned anything in the last, it's being a port, and like it has been the best experience ever. But I tell you what, as soon as I think I'm any good, something shit happens. I guarantee it. I think I'll walk out one day thinking I'm great. Then the next day I'll do something will happen and I'll feel like an absolute fucking youngster again. And that's, and I guess maybe that's because I try and reflect a little bit, or I'd rather have that feeling than thinking I'm great all the time. And, you know, you're this ignorance is bliss, because those guys will end up going nowhere. Whereas I think that, you know, pride comes before a fall, and every day is that, I think, for us, or it should be. We just try and minimize those little falls, I guess. But it's so funny because, yeah, it's been such a pattern in these last few years, where, you know, you think, oh, okay, now I'm finally getting somewhere, you know, doing podcast, you're working in professional sport, and then all of a sudden, you're just as dumb, and you're not as good as you think you are. And it's quite humbling, I guess, as well. But I guess that's always a good thing. You know, puts me back in my box.
Yes, I like that. I was talking to Kier when I'm flat about that yesterday, how I'm just, you know, unless we're hiding somewhere and having our assistants do all the work, like every single day, you'll be challenged to do the fundamentals well. So if you fall asleep at the wheel, people are going to notice right away. I like that. Final question that I'm going to steal from Kier and from Tim Ferriss out of my own version. All right, someone's fresh out of high school, about to start an undergrad in sports science. You're going to give them one training-related book or field-related book and one book that is not related to the field, and you're hoping that they read them over and over and that it will help them become a top practitioner or land a great job by 30. What are those two books?
That's a really, really good question. I don't know. I'm a bit of a book hoard as well. I love books. I love reading. And I sort of cheat a little bit now with audiobooks and that sort of side of things. I think that's been interesting for me. One sort of textbook. In terms of the diversity of what it gives you, and actually the little bit of insight, I think you can't get past Joyce and Lunan's High Performance for Sport book. Mm-hmm. I think that it's just, you know, in terms of, I wish it was around whenever I started out. I remember digging through Super Training. I remember having to spend an inordinate amount of money on Amazon to get it shipped to Northern Ireland, and Yeah, I didn't understand every other word. I was Googling as much as anybody in terms of trying to get through that. So, you know, there's obviously layers to this. I think that, yeah, that's a great start in terms of a textbook for S&C or sports performance or sport in general.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of a non-sporting book, there's so many out there, and I think that the book, maybe if it's just a book that sort of sparked a lot in me, and it was Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. But I remember exactly where I was reading the book, and it was sort of before it all became popular. It was before the 10,000-hour rule became before Ross Tucker started smashing the crap out of it on the internet, and it was before all that sort of stuff. So, and I remember reading it. It wasn't the 10,000-hour thing was been and gone, and that wasn't the thing that did it for me. It was more this active, deliberate practice and expertise, and it sort of clicked on me that, oh, what we're trying to make our athletes experts. And I guess that analogy of making our athletes into PhDs, you know, they're going to have a PhD in their work, in their athleticism, in their sport. I think that fits really nicely with that sort of line of thinking. So that's probably the book for me. I've read so many good books recently, over the years in different areas, which have always sort of sparks something in me. And I think that's probably one of the hot tips, or one of the things that I'd sort of rant a little bit about, is that you can sort of be a passenger when you're reading these books, and you can just sort of go through it, and then you regurgitate what these guys say. And I don't want to hear what Nassim Taleb says. And
I knew you were going to say that.
A paragraph of his book, because he's not saying anything about sports performance.
Yeah.
He's not really, you know, he's talking about himself doing his weightlifting stuff. You should be able to have a greater understanding of what he's trying to say and the points he's trying to make, to then be able to apply it to your real world. And some of the times you can't, and that's fair enough. But I'm not going to sit here and shoehorn those theories into what I feel is important for me. So sure, in terms of anti-fragility and stuff like that, there's always stuff there for us to take advantage of. I think one of the big things about books, and people always ask, and I've got caught so many times, oh, I'm reading these 20 books at the moment, aren't I great? I've done it more than once, and I sort of
catch
myself afterwards going, oh, that's a really dicky thing to do. But and one of the things that people don't really talk about is that, yeah, okay, I'm reading this, you know, Keir's reading some other book, you're reading, it's a book about philosophy and, you know, that side of things. I think that, yeah, but that's what's really interesting for us right now. I don't think that 5 years ago I could be reading stuff and I'd have no freaking idea. It would have no relationship to how I feel about things now. I think that you have to sort of build things, and that's sort of the beautiful journey that people go on, you know. And that's why I say, like, Outliers is probably the book that got me, that sparked something in me, that gave me that drive, or sparked the ignition, to steal another person's term. That's that for me. And at that time, so that was probably just after sort of undergrad, and where I was trying to make my way a little bit. I think that's what sparked me. So I think that, yeah, we all want to gobble up these books and read everything that everybody else is doing with this fear of missing out, but yeah, the first year uni guys that are reading Franz Boas's book, they're going to take a completely different concept from what you are, from what Nick Little is, to what all these other brilliant people out there. So I think that we've got to realize that, and you know, it's maybe like a pathway as you progress, that books become more relevant or become irrelevant as you go along. So I think, yeah, sorry for taking up more of your time, more of these guys' time, but I think that's an important thing, that when we talk about books, oh, we can't just go out and, you know, anyone can buy a book on Amazon and put it on their Kindle and never read it. But I think that it's about the timing as well as the actual content of the books, which is really, really crucial.
Yes, and I think we're incredibly lucky that books remain, and so we can go back and read them over and over, and they'll say something different to us. Because I read Outliers the summer before freshman year of college, and he came and spoke at my university the first week of university for me, and signed the book for me, and then I went back and read it again, and when I had that emotional connection, it gave me something completely different than when I just read it because I had to for my English class.
Yeah.
Ian McCune, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me yet again.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. Check back next week for a great chat with Franz Bosch. In the meantime, if you leave a review of this podcast on iTunes, you'll get a free coaching session with me. See you soon.
To learn more about how you can achieve maximum performance with minimum fuss, sign up to our free newsletter at welltraveledwellness.com. You'll get actionable insights from real people on how they manage their days to lead ultra-healthy and productive lifestyles. Sign up today at welltraveledwellness.com.